We'll turn then, if you have a Bible, to the third passage that we read this morning, Deuteronomy chapter 5, verses 17 to 33. And just to remind you then, we are working through this book of Deuteronomy. We're presently in the Ten Commandments, and our relatively brisk approach to the Ten Commandments reflects the fact that Moses himself is going to go back over them slowly and challengingly during the course of the ensuing chapters. So without further ado then this morning, let's dive back into the commandments after our two-week break from them. And let's dive back in at verse 17, commandment number 6, you shall not murder. Now, in many ways, this is a very obvious and uncontroversial ethic. You can take cultures that are geographically and religiously and temperamentally very different, cultures with radically different attitudes toward dress and property and gender roles and the status of animals and the meaning of life and a thousand other issues besides. And yet you will normally find that there is agreement on this point. You will find that there is a common disapproval of murder. You will find that there is nearly always some form, at least, of anti-murder legislation, no matter which culture it is that you are examining. You look at our own society today, and we have ruthlessly sifted the Ten Commandments, haven't we? Commandments 1 to 3 have gone because they are off the wall and irrelevant. Commandment 4 has gone because it's petty and restrictive. Commandments 5 and 7 have gone because they're outdated and idealistic. Commandment 10 has gone because it's illiberal and invasive. Really, there are only 3 left. Only 3 commandments which our society still accepts as sane and valid and reasonable. But this murder prohibition is certainly one of them. It still resonates with people. It still commands respect. It still is regarded as a definitive moral boundary over which no decent human being should ever go. We have in Britain our national heroes, sporting heroes, political heroes, military heroes, and so on. But almost as prominent in our national psyche are our anti-heroes, Myra Hindley and Harold Shipman and Ian Huntley and men and women like that who crossed this uncrossable moral boundary. So in many ways, I'm saying, it's an obvious and an uncontroversial ethic. But having said that, I think it wouldn't be right for us to move on this morning without just reminding ourselves of one very sobering reality, and it's this. This sin of murder has something of an instinctive aspect to it. It has something of an instinctive aspect to it. You know how in Genesis chapter 3 and those events in the Garden of Eden, mankind there lost his original innocence. His heart became corrupt. Now you'd have thought, wouldn't you, that from then on, there would have been a slow and gradual decline in the moral tone of the human race. So first of all, the emergence of quarrelling and boasting and laziness and gluttony and those kinds of sin. But then as time went by, the emergence of drunkenness and lying and theft and sexual promiscuity and those more serious kinds of sin. And then as still more time went by, the eventual emergence of idol worship and rape and violence and those really serious kinds of sin. You'd have thought that there would be something like that kind of process, something like that kind of pattern. And as for murder then, well, you'd have thought it wouldn't have occurred for centuries. You'd have thought it would be ages and ages until man stooped as low as that. But that's not how it happened, is it? There wasn't any slow and gradual decline. It didn't take centuries for murder to rear its ugly head. How long did it take? in literary terms, one chapter. In historical terms, one generation. And there was Cain. And sin was still such a recent phenomenon in the human DNA. And paradise was still within living memory. And the dust had only just settled from the fall of man. And Cain had never watched a violent movie. And he never played a violent computer game. And he never encountered a single precedent that might possibly have given him the idea of killing his brother. But one day Cain was angry. One day Cain was enraged. One day Cain was incensed. And he just instinctively, in that state of mind, went on the warpath. He just instinctively went in pursuit of blood. He just instinctively lashed out with murderous intent. Moses, the man to whom God is giving these commandments, he knew something about this from personal experience, didn't he? Many years earlier, before the Exodus, during those dark days of the Egyptian bondage, Moses had once witnessed an Egyptian savagely beating a Hebrew slave. And Moses had responded to that situation by killing the Egyptian taskmaster. Now, quite apart from any moral considerations, that was a pretty pointless thing to do, wasn't it? The death of one Egyptian wasn't going to change anything. It wasn't going to overturn Pharaoh's regime. It wasn't going to bring freedom to the Israelite community. It wasn't going to leave so much as a dent in the Egyptian tyranny. In fact, it wasn't even going to secure more than a few minutes respite for that one particular Hebrew slave who was being beaten. It was pointless. It was stupid. It was irrational. But in the heat of his indignation, in the heat of his outrage, as he saw that situation unfolding before his eyes, that was instinctively how Moses responded. Now, it might seem ridiculous for me to be making this application. It might seem almost laughable that you've come to church this morning to hear your minister telling you not to go and murder anybody. But I think we need to realize, don't we, just how corrupt we are as human beings. We need to realize, as my former minister in Cambridge would often put it, that there's no sin so depraved that you and I could not stoop to it. And we need to realize in particular just how vulnerable we are in moments of anger. We need to realize, of course, that as Jesus brought out in the Sermon on the Mount, anger is a serious issue in and of itself, unaccompanied by any actions. But we need to realize too that anger often doesn't remain unaccompanied by actions. We need to realize that it can trigger within us the most base and appalling instincts. We need to realize that in its grip we can do things which we would never normally do. I'm saying then that it's an obvious ethic, but we must always bear this in mind. There's something instinctive about this sin which is being prohibited in the sixth commandment. Well, let's move on to the seventh commandment, verse 18. You shall not commit adultery. Now, this commandment is very obviously then referring to sexual sin. And although it undoubtedly has a broader application to all kinds of sexual sin, I think we need to understand that it's primarily talking about a sexual relationship between two persons who aren't married to each other, but at least one of whom is married. That's the precise sin that is primarily in view here in verse 18. And I just want to focus really on one thing in connection with this sin of adultery, and it's this. The fact that this prohibition here comes in between the prohibition of murder on the one hand and the prohibition of theft on the other hand suggests to me that we are dealing here with a horizontal kind of sin. A sin that is directed against a fellow human being. A sin that leaves in its wake a human victim. Now, don't get me wrong. All sins are ultimately committed against God. I know that. I've read Psalm 51. That's an important truth that we all need to be aware of. All sins are ultimately committed against God himself. But you understand the point I'm making, that murder is self-evidently a sin against the person that you kill. And theft is self-evidently a sin against the person you steal from. And similarly then, I think that the placing of this commandment in between those two is suggesting that adultery has the same character, that it is a sin against the person that you are married to and or the person that this lover of yours is married to. And I stress this because I think we easily neglect this aspect of it. I think that when we come to the seventh commandment, we would often focus on the illicit sex itself and the dirtiness of that, rather than upon the innocent victim and the tragedy of that. But that, I think, is where the biblical emphasis falls, upon the innocent victim in cases of adultery. It comes across so powerfully in that passage we read earlier on, 2 Samuel chapter 12. David has committed adultery, and somehow he doesn't seem to have registered the fact properly. He doesn't seem to be feeling any kind of guilt about it. And so God sends to him Nathan, the prophet, and Nathan comes to him then to spell out exactly what it is that David has done. And you would have thought, therefore, that that passage would be calculated to make us blush. You'd have thought it would be an X-rated, sexually explicit kind of passage. Nathan saying, look, David, you did this with Bathsheba, and you did this with Bathsheba, and you did this with Bathsheba. But there's none of that, is there? Because the focus of Nathan's message isn't upon what David has done with Bathsheba, it's upon what David has done to Uriah. He's that poor man in the parable that Nathan tells, who only had one little ewe lamb, and whose one little ewe lamb, his beautiful wife Bathsheba, had been so callously taken from him. And that, you see, is the horror then of adultery. That murder leaves people dead, and theft leaves people poor, and similarly adultery leaves people betrayed and cheated and heartbroken. And we need to get that into our minds, I think. You see, our society is always telling us, isn't it, that what matters most is my personal happiness and my personal fulfillment. That's what matters, my happiness, my fulfillment. And if, therefore, I am a married man, but there's a woman in the office, and we get on well, and there's a chemistry between us, and we're attracted to each other, then the message that I receive is, well, I shouldn't worry about any other factors. I shouldn't take any other factors into consideration. I should just go for it. Because a sexual relationship with that woman will mean happiness and fulfillment for me. And we've got to think completely differently to that. We've got to turn that on its head completely. No, a sexual relationship with that woman will not mean happiness and fulfillment for me. It will mean tragedy and devastation for someone else. For some poor woman who many years earlier I committed myself to, in sickness and in health, for richer and for poorer, until death us do part. That's what adultery does. It leaves broken dreams and shattered lives. It leaves victims in its wake. It leaves lifelong scars and incurable wounds. Our society today is at breaking point with those kind of tragic stories. In family after family, in home after home, pain and distress and disillusionment. Because this thing called marriage, designed to be so beautiful and exclusive and lifelong, has been compromised and tampered with. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying adultery is unforgivable. Not for one moment am I saying that. Like any other sin, you take that sin to Jesus Christ in faith and you will find that he washes you clean. in the fullest and most unqualified sense. There is cleansing for every sin with Jesus Christ and his cross. We must remember that. But I am saying that adultery is a horrible thing, and we must see it for what it really is. That's the seventh commandment. Let's move on to the eighth commandment. You shall not steal. You shall not steal. And again, I think there's a great danger that here too we entertain a wrong idea in our minds. I think that often when we think about the eighth commandment, our thoughts are more influenced by Charles Dickens than by the Bible. And we kind of instinctively think in terms of this kind of underclass of dirty young urchins kind of roaming the streets and pickpocketing all these good, decent, middle-class folk who are just going about their ordinary daily business. That's the kind of mental image that perhaps we often have when we think of theft and this commandment, you shall not steal. But when you read Deuteronomy, and when you read the Old Testament prophets, the theft, the kind of theft that is generally being highlighted and condemned in the Old Testament, isn't being carried out by dirty young urchins. It's being carried out by businessmen and merchants. It's being carried out by people who have a respectable place in society. And it's being carried out then through their use of dishonest weighing scales, conning their customers on the markets. It's being carried out through their exploitation of workers, not treating them properly, paying them less than their services have merited. That's the kind of theft that is most commonly identified and condemned in the Old Testament. It's not a lower class thing against a higher class. It's a higher class thing against the lower and underprivileged classes. And still today, I think we need to see the relevance of that particular application that is so prominent in the Old Testament. Now, of course, the Eighth Commandment can be applied broadly as well, and it does apply to domestic burglaries and armed robberies. And if you've had your mobile phone stolen or your iPod or whatever it might be, then you've of course, experience the violation of the Eighth Commandment. But I think in a particular way, we should see its application to the realm of trade and commerce. It's an interesting question, isn't it? What is the hardest area, the hardest professional area for a Christian to operate in our society today? And I suppose you could discuss that at great length, and it'd be very hard to come down on a definite answer. So you could say, well, it's the medical realm. It's very hard for a Christian to work and operate there as a doctor and so on because of all the ethical issues, abortion, euthanasia, IVF, and all these kinds of things. Or you could say, well, it's the scientific realm. It's very hard for a Christian to be a scientist because of the evolutionary worldview, which is so prevalent in the scientific world. And so you could go down that line. Or I suppose you could say, well, it's very hard for a Christian to work at local council level because of all the diversity and equality policies which he or she would be expected to promote. That would be very hard. That is very hard for a Christian to live with. Or I suppose you could say, well, a professional sports person. The culture of heavy drinking, the seductiveness of celebrity status, that is another very hard area for a Christian to operate in. And all of that is true. But what about a Christian salesperson for whom it's increasingly hard, perhaps, to make enough profit to make a living without, to some extent at least, conning clients and customers? Without to some extent at least pulling the wool over their eyes and being ethically dubious in negotiating a deal so that effectively that customer or client is being stolen from. What about the Christian employer for whom it's so hard in a competitive global market to succeed, to thrive, to be viable, and at the same time treat less skilled workers properly without working them the maximum amount of time for the minimum amount of pay and effectively stealing from them. And so I think we need to realize then that theft in its biblical, in its Old Testament, penetrating definition is endemic, isn't it, within our business world today. And we must pray for those Christians who are operating in that realm. And we must pray that God will enable them to operate in that realm with integrity and to do so with a God-honoring allegiance to this eighth commandment, you shall not steal. Ninth commandment, you shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. This is verse 20. And as we said then with the seventh commandment, I think the important thing to notice here too is that we're dealing with a horizontal kind of sin, a sin that is directed against another human being. We often tend to talk about this commandment, I think, in very abstract terms. We talk about lying and untruthfulness in very abstract terms. Now, of course, lying can be abstract. If there's a visitor here this morning and I'm talking to that visitor at the door on the way out and I say, "Hi there, my name's Keith, I'm 54 years old and I'm from Merseyside," then I would be telling a series of lies. But they would be fairly abstract lies in that they wouldn't be lies directed against any person in particular. And again, I think we should see that at a secondary level, this commandment can be applied to lying generally, lying full stop. But we need to notice that primarily that's not what it's talking about, because it's specifically then false testimony against your neighbour. Strictly speaking, it's actually talking about lying in court. It's envisaging a legal setting. And it's talking then about, in a court scenario, bringing a false accusation against someone in order to incriminate that person and to ruin their reputation. And again, and I think it's specifically at that level that we ought to be primarily applying it, not just to court, although of course still today it's very possible to bring a false accusation against someone in court and to ruin their reputation in that way. But there are other ways, aren't there? Much easier ways of ruining someone's reputation by telling lies. You can do it in the playground at school by just spreading untrue stories about somebody. You can do it in the workplace by engaging in untrue gossip about somebody. You can do it in the church by perhaps in very pious language sometimes subtly disseminating false information about somebody. And the commandments are saying then that you can assault somebody physically through murder, and you can assault somebody sexually through adultery, but you can also assault somebody verbally through telling untrue things about them, through raising matters which aren't true in order to assassinate that person's character. And we need to recognize that, and we need to get out of our heads that whole inane idea, it's only words. Words aren't important. Words aren't serious. Words can be very serious indeed. And we must be very careful about the temptation to be scurrilous, the temptation to be gossiping, the temptation to be loose in what we say to and about other people. That's specifically the sin that's in view here. It's ruining someone's reputation and character by telling a lie about them. Tenth commandment, verse 21, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife, you shall not set your desire in your neighbor's house or land, his manservant or maidservant, his ox or donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. Now, in many ways, I think this is the most radical of all the commandments, because this commandment isn't addressing any action. It isn't addressing any words, even. It isn't addressing anything that you could ever possibly be convicted of in a human court. What's it addressing? Well, that crucial word in the second sentence, "you shall not set your desire." That's what it's addressing. It's addressing desire. It's addressing the desires of our hearts. And I spoke of this in our opening prayer this morning, but it does remind us, doesn't it, of the nature of our redemption. How often have we sung those great words of Isaac Watts, "Love so amazing, so divine, demands my soul, my life, my all." And how often have we sung those words, perhaps transported to some extent by the tune and the music and the fact that we're in a congregation with many others, but not really grappling with what exactly we are singing when we utter those words. I'm sure that the Israelites were often tempted to be similarly superficial when they gather together for worship, and when they look back to their redemption, when they look back to what God had done for them in bringing them out of Egypt. Perhaps at times they were tempted to utter similarly unthought through cliches, "love so amazing, so divine, demands my soul, my life, my all." And this 10th commandment, you see, would constantly therefore be bringing them back to earth with a bump. And be constantly reminding them, look, when you say my soul, my life, my all, it means my soul, my life, my all. Even the desires of your hearts, that's what God wants. He purchased you even to have from you your desires. Even to make sure that they are addressed and they are straightened out and they are brought into conformity with his will and his character. And I think too that it's very interesting that this comes then at the end, this commandment, "you shall not covet." And I think that in many ways there's a profound connection between it and the others that we've been looking at this morning. I think in many ways this commandment can often lie behind all the others that we have considered today. So, for instance, "you shall not murder." Well, we have those words, don't we, in James's epistle, James chapter 4, first couple of verses. "What causes fights and quarrels among you? Don't they come from your desires that battle within you? You want something but don't get it. You kill and covet, but you cannot have what you want." Now, I'm not fully sure whether James there is talking about killing in a literal sense or in a metaphorical sense. But the point is, he's drawing a connection there, isn't he, between the covetous desire and the murderous expression of it. Certainly you go back to Cain and that first murder, and I think there was a covetous motivation there, wasn't there? He wanted something he knew his brother had and he didn't have. His brother had a holy, godly life and therefore a good relationship with the living God, and he didn't want that. So he didn't have that. And rather than going about it in the proper way and repenting and sharing in what his brother had, instead he just gave himself over to covetousness and he murdered his brother. It's fascinating, isn't it, that in Romans 7, Paul talks about his kind of initial conviction of sin in that a time when he became a Christian, his initial conviction of sin, and the particular sin that he focuses on is the sin of covetousness. It seems that covetousness played a real role in Paul's conversion, a real role in his conviction of sin. And I've heard it suggested, it's only speculative, but I've heard it suggested that perhaps the occasion that really brought that covetousness to life in Paul was when he witnessed Stephen. And for the first time, as he saw Stephen, and as he saw Stephen giving that brilliant defense of Christianity, for the first and a brilliant survey of the Old Testament, for the first time, Saul of Tarsus was coming up against someone who could outdo him, someone who knew the Old Testament better than he knew it, someone who understood theology better than he understood it, and he coveted and he wanted that. And perhaps that was why he participated with such relish in Stephen's death, in Stephen's stoning, in Stephen's martyrdom. Again, possibly a covetous motive to that murder. Or you think of adultery. And again, you go back to David, the Bible's most famous adulterer. And, of course, what was the occasion there? It wasn't that David was just sitting in his room and he thought, well, I'd like a bit of fun, and so he called one of his servants to go and get him a girl from somewhere. No, David was out on his rooftop, on his balcony, and he saw Bathsheba. And he saw this beautiful woman, and he coveted, he wanted that woman. And covetousness then was definitely behind his adultery. It's why both Job in the Old Testament and then Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount, they both connect adultery to the eyes, don't they? To the lustful look with the eyes, because that's where it so often starts. It doesn't start as adultery, actually. It starts as covetousness. It starts with wanting that woman or that person of the opposite sex whom you have seen. And that's why then here in the commandment itself, that's how it starts, isn't it? You shall not covet your neighbor's wife. And it's kind of a separate clause, isn't it, from the rest of the commandment? Because that is such a potent and common form of covetous desire, the covetous desire which then leads on to adultery. Theft, well, that's obviously often has covetousness lying behind it. I've spoken already this morning of the way in which a particular form of theft is so endemic within our world today and within our business, economic world. And of course, that's driven by covetousness, isn't it? It's driven by this desire for more wealth and more possessions and more things. False testimony. Well, covetousness can sometimes lie behind that. We read a passage earlier on where it did. That passage in Kings where you had Ahab and he wanted Naboth's vineyard. He coveted that vineyard that belonged to Naboth. And of course, he himself couldn't see any way when Naboth declined him. He couldn't see any way in which he could get the vineyard. But Jezebel was a bit more resourceful, and so she came up with the idea, well, we'll just produce some scoundrels. We'll produce some false witnesses, some people who can bring false testimony against Naboth. And so you see false testimony being used in the service of covetousness. And so it's this last commandment is saying then that covetousness can be the root of so many evils. And that's why we've got to watch our hearts. We've got to be policemen and policewomen over our inmost desires. We can't just settle for how our external actions are. We've got to be watching our hearts. We've got to be praying through this with the Holy Spirit's help. Lord, search me and know me. Lord, help me to put to death those covetous impulses which, left unbridled, will lead to all kinds of other evils. Well, our time has gone, and you notice that I read earlier on the last few verses of the chapter as well, and in many ways those verses are repeating other things that we've come across in Deuteronomy, and I don't want to therefore go through them in any detail. I'm just going to mention, just in just a couple of minutes, three things that we see in these last verses, verses 22 to 33. Notice, first of all, the completeness of the Ten Commandments. Because we read then in verse 22, "These are the commandments the Lord proclaimed in a loud voice to your whole assembly there on the mountain from out of the fire, the cloud, and the deep darkness. And he added nothing more." And you think, well, that's nonsense, because we're only at chapter 5 and there's tons more to come. But as we've said before, I think the point is that actually the Ten Commandments are the law of God. They are the law in and of themselves. And all we have then in the rest of Deuteronomy from chapter 6 onwards is the application of the Ten Commandments. If you want the law of God, this is where you find it in Deuteronomy 5. If you want the application, you move on to the rest of the book. And I think it's important to bear that in mind. So the completeness of the Ten Commandments. Secondly, notice the role of Moses. This is in verses 23 to 27, and the way in which then the Israelites, you remember, there at Horeb, there at Sinai, they had been terrified because God had appeared in such dazzling and splendid and glorious form. And so you remember they had asked Moses to go into God's presence on their behalf and to bring revelation back to them from God. So Moses was to come out of the otherwise inaccessible presence of God with revelation for the people of God. And I think it's a significant moment, that, because of course it's starting a whole line, a whole tradition that was then going to continue throughout the rest of the Old Testament, of men coming out of the otherwise inaccessible presence of God with revelation from God, prophets, throughout the remainder of the Old Testament. But not only that, but of course it's pointing us to the culmination of that line, the culmination of that tradition, which would be one man who, in a greater sense than any of his predecessors, would come out of the inaccessible presence of God and bring us revelation of what God is like. That man was Jesus Christ. And his revelation, of course, wouldn't simply be words, like Moses' revelation was, and like the other prophets' revelation was. His revelation would be his whole person, his whole life. He is himself the revelation. Perhaps you've sometimes asked the question, what is God like? It's the biggest question you can ever ask, isn't it? What is God like? The answer is, look at Jesus Christ. That's what God is like. Think God, think Jesus. He is the form, the image, the reality of God. And then thirdly and finally, notice the yearning of God. The yearning of God. Verse 29, the Lord heard you when you spoke to me, and the Lord said to me, I have heard what this people said to you. Everything they said was good. And then these astonishing words, oh, that their hearts would be inclined to fear me and keep all my commands always, so that it might go well with them and their children forever. Wonderful words those, aren't they? So often I think we have an image of God as this harsh God, this difficult God, who wants to make life for us, his people, as hard as he possibly can. He's always trying to trip us up. He's always trying to get us in a corner. He's always trying to land us in a mess. That's the kind of God he is, who enjoys seeing his people in a spot of bother. And this is reminding us, no, that's not what God is like. God wants with all his heart us to be living in accordance with his laws. God yearns that we might be living out his holy laws. And I think as well we have to remember something else, don't we? That when God yearns for something, he doesn't yearn for it impotently and toothlessly. We do. We yearn for all sorts of things, but we can't bring them about. God's not like that. When God yearns for something, God can bring it about. And I think, therefore, that the appropriate note on which to close is to jump to 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. And the last part of that chapter, I think I mentioned this passage when we had our series on holiness a few months ago. And they're wonderful, encouraging words. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verses 23 and 24, where Paul writes this, may God himself, the God of peace, sanctify you. That means make you holy. May God himself make you holy through and through. May your whole spirit, soul, and body be kept blameless at the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ. And then these wonderful words, the one who calls you is faithful, and he will do it. God will do it. God will make us holy. Now, if you're a true Christian this morning, that won't make you complacent and just sit back and say, well, in that case, I don't have to do anything. Now, if you're a true Christian this morning, however, it will encourage you greatly as you feel the heat of the battle, as you feel the temptations you're surrounded by on every side. It will encourage you that when you sometimes can't see that you're making any progress, this is the reality. God is committed to sanctifying you through and through, and the one who has called you is faithful. And he will do it. He yearns for your holiness. And he will bring it about. Amen. Let's close with hymn 653, Love Divine or Love's Excelling. And the last verse then takes up that theme, finish then thy new creation. That's us it's talking about. Pure and spotless let us be. Let us see thy great salvation perfectly restored in thee. Let us see us then perfectly restored in you. Changed from glory into glory till in heaven we take our place. Let's sing hymn 653 to God's praise.